Mira's first thought on coming home to an empty flat had been that Shelley had finally done it, packed up all her things and left without warning and without a note. After calling Shelley's name and hearing no reply, she stood in the open doorway for several seconds, reconciling herself to the new, though long-expected reality of Shelley being gone. Before her vision clarified and she saw that Shelley's bike was still in the laundry and her shoes were still piled beneath the radiator and her beloved bomber jacket was still hanging on its coat hook in the hall. Feeling foolish, Mira hastily revised her thought to wonder, instead, if some sudden emergency had taken Shelley from the house. But if that were the case, then wouldn't she have called, or texted at the very least? She remembered suddenly the location tracker app that they had both installed some months ago, and never used. She got out her phone to check if the connection was still active, but in the brief time it took for the device to fetch Shelley's data from whatever configuration of satellites and local masts were coordinating her position, she grew ashamed of the intrusion and exited the map before it fully loaded, reproaching herself that it was no wonder Shelley had been feeling smothered, and wondering, not for the first time, when exactly she had become so technologically dependent that her first instinct in every unpredicted circumstance was to outsource her imagination to her phone. 2 weeks had passed since she first divined that Shelley wanted out of Burnham Wood, and for 2 weeks she had been paralyzed by the same mute and stricken helplessness that she had felt when her parents first announced their separation, chiding herself, as she had then, that at her age and state of independence, it was absurd that she should feel so childishly forsaken, and so sad. Mira was a remorseless critic of her own emotions. She frequently disparaged what she felt and thought, and she was quick to punish anything she judged to be a sign of moral weakness, no matter how privately or invisibly it was expressed. She hated how the divorce had come to quantify her relationships with both her parents, such that one weekend dinner with her mother now placed her one weekend dinner with her father in debt. And every conversation, every holiday, every shared interest, even every congenital resemblance now felt inscribed in a vast ledger of credit and debit that somehow it was her responsibility to balance. She felt cheapened by the effort, monetized, contractualized, demeaned. And so she did not allow the feeling. Instead, she simply squashed it, telling herself, in a tone of matronly admonishment, that divorce was not uncommon, that other people were vastly more unfortunate, and that unless her health or her life had been threatened, then she had no business to complain. So it was with Shelley now. Mira was devastated by the thought of her departure, but her instinct for self-censure was so strong that she denied her devastation almost before she'd even identified that that was what it was. This left her with a sense of being both entirely bereft and entirely blameworthy, having condemned herself for what she would not permit herself to feel. The maxim of Mira's childhood had been that she was older than her years. Her parents had been fond of entertaining, and when she was young, it had been a point of pride for them that she could hold her own among their adult friends, sitting up late at the dinner table in the bohemian detritus of empty bottles and dripping candles burning low, following the conversation, and even interjecting now and then with her own precocious point of view. When she was a child, her father had worked as an urban planner for the city council, and her mother as an academic in the field of international relations. Their circle of acquaintance was wide, and, as Mira would only really comprehend much later, almost universally left-wing, a fact that naturally came to shape Mira's own political expressions, for her contributions at the table were never more appreciated than when they reflected what was commonly agreed. She had grown up with a stout faith in the proven clarity of right and wrong, and had never doubted for a moment that to be treated as an adult was better than to be treated as a child. But she had feared, in lonely moments, that for her parents she existed merely as a kind of party trick, a dazzling proof of how well she had been parented, a living testament not to her own powers of conviction and discernment, but to theirs. Even as an adult, she could not dispel, at times, a nagging sense of fraudulence, that she was most valued for what she most easily performed. Her parents had been surprised by her vocation. Like many ardent followers of politics, they tended towards impatience when it came to the processes of natural change. They were indifferent gardeners and had kept a compost heap more to reduce the volume of their household waste than out of any fascination for its uses. The backyard of Mira's childhood home had been mostly laid to lawn. There was a raised bed against the bottom fence that Mira's father had turned into a sandpit when she was very young, only to be abandoned when the neighborhood cats began to use it as a litter box. It had stayed untouched for almost a decade, the plastic starfish and crenellated buckets fading to pastel against the darkening crust of sand, before anyone raised the prospect of restoring the bed to its proper function, which had happened, Mira could remember exactly, on the evening of her first day of high school. At her year 9 induction, she had been paired with a girl named Emily Alcorn, whose lunch contained the unimaginable sophistication of cherry tomatoes, basil leaves, and baby mozzarella balls, each ingredient stored in a separate compartment and then combined, with great ritual and solemnity, on the back of her lunchbox lid. Mira had been entranced. She had rushed home to beg her mother to begin buying cherry tomatoes instead of regular, and her mother, who at the time was reading a self-help book on the power of initiative, had replied that maybe she should try to grow her own. The challenge was accepted with far more seriousness than it had been made. By the following year, Mira had 24 different crops in germination and had extended the reconverted sandpit the full length of the fence. She planted marigolds as pesticides, planted crop rotations, built cold frames and hotbeds, saved the family's coffee grounds for mulch, and the more her parents wondered at her perseverance, the more she persevered. With her schoolmates, however, she was intensely secretive and took to pushing soft soap beneath her fingernails before she gardened to make it easier afterwards to wash away the dirt. She knew that horticulture was a strange passion for a teenage girl, and for all her inherent unconventionality, she was not above the adolescent terror of exposure, the dread of never being normal and never fitting in. Emily Alcorn had long since moved on to other friends, and no doubt other lunches. But she remained for Mira a kind of private benchmark of refinement and good taste, an image that was largely fantasy, since they had hardly spoken on the day of their induction, and after it, they never spoke again. None of Mira's boyfriends had ever lasted more than a couple of months, and because she had never been the kind of girl to claim best friendships, it had come almost as a shock to recognize, belatedly, that her relationship with Shelley had been the closest and most constant of her adult life. She was ashamed to realize how completely she had taken Shelley's friendship for granted, all the more because a source of private guilt for her was the fact, never openly acknowledged, that deep down she preferred the company of men. Her favored style of conversation was impassioned argument that bordered on seduction, and although it was distasteful, not to mention tactically unwise, to admit that one enjoyed flirtation, she never felt freer or funnier or more imaginatively potent than when she was the only woman in the room. If ever this preference were to be pointed out to her, Mira knew that she would stridently deny it. She felt that it exposed a defect in her character, disloyalty to her own sex, first of all, but deeper than that, a vanity, an appetite, a capacity for manipulation that she would rather other people did not see. She knew, and was ashamed to know, that one of the reasons she had never taken Shelley's friendship all that seriously was that it lacked any sense of sexual possibility or contest. There was no danger between them, nothing fearsome or uncertain, no provocation, no romance. With Shelley, she always knew that she was safe. Except she wasn't, because she had treated Shelley badly, and now Shelley wanted out. And Mira found herself, as she had with her parents' separation, in a situation where her most cherished and most practiced social skills were simply of no use. Debate was worthless, the exercise of charm beside the point, and having committed, long ago, to the performance of a mature and self-sufficient rationality, she now found herself without either the language or the power to express how deeply she was grieving. She wished more than anything that she could reverse her course, convey more gratitude and sympathy, show more interest in Shelley's inner life, confess, as she could still barely confess to herself, that the air of fearless self-assurance she projected was merely an imposture, a front designed to ward off intimacy and to banish her immense uncertainty and moral guilt. She wished that she could tell her friends the honest truth, which was not that she loved her because she needed her, but that she needed her because she loved her. And in her monumental stupidity and self-absorption, she had only just figured that out. Mira disliked to feel that she was wallowing. She tended to follow moments of severe self-criticism with rapid and decisive action. She had come home intending to suggest to Shelley that they drive down to Thorndyke on the weekend, a 5-hour trip that would take them well outside their usual sphere of operation and afford them both a healthy change of scene. Cycling back to the flat that afternoon, she had imagined describing to Shelley what a single season at the Darvish farm could do for Burnham Wood, had envisaged Shelley's excitement at the prospect of the trip, had conjured in her mind's eye the conversation that in recent weeks had become a persistent and increasingly alluring fantasy. Shelley confiding, with none of the fatigued apprehension or forced politeness that had dogged her manner lately, that she had been on the verge of leaving. But this, Mira had auditioned many schemes for this, had changed her mind. Now, standing in the kitchen with her phone loose in her hand, Mira rebuked herself again for having indulged in such craven wishful thinking. She told herself sternly that Shelley needed space, and then resolved, immediately, to be the one to give it to her. Even before she had fully voiced the thought, she was decided. She would go to Thorndyke alone, at once, tonight. She would scope out the farm. She would give Shelley a few days to relax, and hopefully to reconsider. And she would come back having killed two birds, as it were, with one stone. She kicked off her shoes and went into her bedroom to pack. One of the reasons that horticulture held such strong appeal for Mira was that it offered her a respite from this habit of relentless interior critique. When she made things grow, she experienced a kind of manifest forgiveness, an abiding moving on and making new that she found impossible in almost every other sphere of life. Even in her failures and mistakes, as when she learned that onion seeds don't tend to keep, or that low soil temperatures result in carrots that are pale, or that fennel inhibits growth in other plants and should be propagated only on its own. She never felt chastised for truth in a garden, did not take the form of rectitude, and right was not the opposite of wrong. To learn even something as simple as to water the roots of a plant rather than its leaves was not to be dealt the harsh reality of cold hard fact, but rather to be let into a secret. In a garden, expertise was personal and anecdotal. It was allegorical, it was ancient, and it had been handed down. One felt that gardeners across the generations were united in a kind of guild, and that every counsel had the quality of wisdom, gentle, patient, and holistic. And yet unwavering, for there was no quarrelling with the laws and tendencies of nature, no room for judgment, no dispute. The proof lay only in the plants themselves, and in the soil, and in the air, and in the harvest. As she saw it, the opportunity presented by the Darvish farm was twofold. The first was the fact of the land itself, 153 good hectares in a town that was likely to remain deserted until at least the spring. None of Burnham's planting sites in the city offered anywhere near that kind of scope. Mira was constantly frustrated by their inability to produce at scale. And if they could just manage to get a season's worth of crops into the ground without getting caught, she thought, then the income they could generate might be enough, in and of itself, to give Burnham Wood a shot at solvency. Maybe Shelley could finally launch the subscription service that she had always talked about. Or maybe they could put the funds towards their own expansion, reaching out to like-minded organizations, perhaps, or registering as a charity. Or maybe even paying for a spot of advertising to grow their client base, little though Mira liked that idea. And if they did get caught, well, that also presented an interesting opportunity. Between the press coverage of the knighthood and the reporting on the landslide on the pass, Thorndyke had been much in the public consciousness in recent months. And if Burnham Wood could stage a demonstration on the Darvish property, Mira thought, if they could arrange to be caught in the act of trespassing, if they could invite prosecution even for the alleged crime of planting a sustainable organic garden on an empty tract of land, and if they could then present to the media exactly what they planted and explain their mission and enumerate their goals and prove themselves to be serious and good-hearted professionals whose work was tidy and efficient and fruitful and thoughtful and respectful of the land, would that not be a form of breaking good? They would risk criminal charges, of course, but at least they'd get their message out. And since Owen Darvish was to be knighted for services to conservation, at the very least they might provoke an interesting debate. As she hunted through her chest of drawers for woolen socks and polypropylenes, she rehearsed in her mind the message she would send to Shelley. "Hey," she imagined writing, "I've been getting the sense that you could do with a bit of space. but that was too accusing. Hey, she tried again. I figured you might appreciate a bit of time to yourself. Too passive-aggressive? Hey, I thought we could both do with a bit of a break. Inaccurate and too cloying. Hey, I've been a bit worried lately that... Hey, I hope I haven't misread this, but... Hey, just to let you know... At last, zipping up her duffel bag, she settled on, Hey, Shell, I'm going to get out of your hair for a few days. Reckon you deserve a break. Interesting possible site in Thorndyke down south. Looks like the town's emptied out post-Kurawai Pass closure, which could be good for us. Breaking good? I'll let you know. Anyway, take care and see you in a bit. X. She typed it out, but hesitated over pressing send. Better perhaps to wait until she was on her way out of town, in case Shelley texted back and asked to come along. Famira had convinced herself that the only practicable course of action left to her was to go to Kurawai alone. She saved the message as a draft and went outside to load the van. Ordinarily, if she were planning a trip as far afield as Thorndyke, she would ask around at Burnham Wood to see if anyone might be heading in the same general direction. She had inherited from Rufus a 1994 Nissan Vanette that routinely failed its warrant and was always breaking down. Its fuel efficiency was poor, especially on the open road. And if she shared the journey even part of the way, then she could ask for $10 or $20 towards the cost of petrol. But thinking about Shelley had left her in a nettled, agitated mood, and she couldn't bear the thought of explaining her intention for the journey, let alone of running the risk that someone might volunteer to join her all the way. And so, to foreclose the possibility completely, she packed the footwell of the passenger seat with her duffel bag and camping gear, and buckled a stack of seed trays onto the seat. The Vanette comfortably slept too. She and Shelley raised occasional income by decamping to somebody's driveway and renting out their flat short term. But whenever Mira was scoping out a site for Burnham Wood, she preferred to park it somewhere inconspicuous and sleep outdoors, alternating between her two tents, one yellow and one navy blue, and never staying anywhere longer than a night. The van had the disadvantage of a license plate, though it had never yet been reported, at least not as far as she knew. She loaded fast, dreading the thought of Shelley coming home and intercepting her. Tools, tarpaulins, silicon buckets for conveying water, fertilizer, half a dozen empty water cooler tanks, an irrigation backpack, salvaged panes of perspex, stakes and shade cloth, seed trays, seeds, canvas bags, polytunnels, a garden hose and sundry different shaped attachments, and her bicycle. But Shelley did not appear, and Mira's phone stayed dark. And 20 minutes later, she had locked the house and was on her way. At her mother's flat, she printed out aerial plans of Thorndyke and the Darvish farm, first in map view and then in satellite, at different scales. She was taking a plastic wallet from her mother's desk to store them in, when she heard the key in the door and her mother calling out her name. Sorry, Mira said, coming out into the hall. I'm blocking the garage. That's fine, I took the bus. Couldn't be stuffed with parking. I'm stealing this, Mira said, holding up the plastic wallet. And I used your printer. And I ate some of your food. Did you see the leftovers? Yeah, sorry. I finished off the dal. I was going to leave a note. Not bad, was it? Really good. Better than from the old place. You should have texted, said Harriet Bunting, hanging up her coat and nudging her shoes into alignment with her toe. I would have cooked you something. I'm not stopping. I'm actually heading out of town, Mira said. But her mother was already padding into the kitchen and opening the fridge. Stay for a glass of wine. How's Shelley? She's fine, Mira said. I can't drink, I'm driving. Small one. No, really. Teensy tiny. Her mother waggled the bottle. Just a splash. You know, Mum, there's a word for what you're doing. Relaxing, her mother said. After a long bloody day. She poured herself a large glass and sighed theatrically. Mira didn't ask her what there was to sigh about. I'm heading down to Thorndyke, she said. Harriet peered at her in pretended consternation. What, tonight? What for? Just for a break. Thought I'd get amongst some green. Thorndyke? Harriet repeated, perplexed. It's a long drive, Mira said. I really should be going. You can stay 2 minutes, Mom, it's a 5-hour drive. Her mother stuck out her bottom lip. I don't like you driving at night. I like it better, Mira said. Less traffic. But if I leave it too late, I'll catch all the drunk drivers coming home from the pub. I really should go. Thorndyke, Harriet said again. It's just for a few days, and I've got my phone. Is your friend still living there? Kevin Gaffney. You're thinking of Rufus. I thought he was your friend. No, Mira said. Kevin Gaffney, her mother said again. His parents had a lifestyle block. They called it their life sentence. I never knew him, Mira said. It was in Thorndyke, her mother said. I'm sure it was. We stayed with them once when we were passing through, and after we went to bed, they had a lover's quarrel, and we heard it through the wall. It was absolutely riveting, start to finish. So interesting to hear how other people argue, especially when you don't know them very well, so you haven't already picked a side. We were practically glued to the wall. Not just me, Roger too. He said it was like going to therapy, the whole thing. Not very effective therapy, Mira thought. You got divorced. Harriet smiled at her. Kevin had a pet rat. Do you remember? No, Mira said. But her mother was laughing now at some private memory. God, Kevin Gaffney, she said. I haven't thought about him in years. Well, I've never thought about him, Mira said tartly, because I've never met him, or his parents, or his rat. Mira, Harriet said reproachfully. What's the matter? Nothing's the matter, she said. I just need to get going. Thanks for the curry. Oh, why don't you stay the night and leave in the morning? Oh, go on, baby girl. Then you could have some wine. She arrived in Thorndyke a little after midnight and parked in the deserted Department of Conservation campsite by the lake. Her phone had buzzed sometime after she turned inland from the coast. And after she had cut the ignition and set the parking brake, she checked it to find 2 messages from Shelley. The first was a bland response to hers. Sounds good. Have fun. X. But the second, sent an hour later, read, Getting okay? Hey, thanks for giving me a bit of headspace. Very kind and much appreciated. Hope all goes well in Korowai. X. Mira felt her mood lift at once. She texted back to say that she'd arrived safely, received a thumbs-up emoji in reply, and went to pitch her tent, feeling great relief and optimism, buoyed by the clean subalpine air and by the deep mossy scent of the outdoors. She could see her breath in the pool of blue light cast by her head torch as she snapped the poles together and drove the pegs into the frosty ground. But the sky was cloudless, and above the black void of the Korowai Ranges, the Milky Way was a liquid swash of white. It was the kind of night, she felt, that could only precede the very best kind of winter's day. Cold, brilliant, and still. Feeling suddenly indulgent, she told herself, kindly, that perhaps she'd been wrong. Perhaps Shelley hadn't been on the verge of leaving after all. Perhaps all she'd needed was a bit of space. Mira climbed into her sleeping bag and lay in the dark, listening to the distant two-toned call of Oruru on the far side of the valley, before the exhaustion of the drive overcame her, and she fell asleep. The next morning dawned just as bright and clear as she had hoped, and after she had struck her tent and made coffee on her little butane stove, she took out her bicycle, loaded the panniers with a day's supply of food and water, and locked the van, first closing the calico curtains and leaving a tramper's guidebook on the dashboard in plain view. Half a dozen walking tracks led from the car park up into the ranges and around the lake, giving a ready explanation, in the unlikely event of an inspection, for where the van's driver might have gone. There was no charge for parking, though welded to the guideboard was an honesty box for camp fees that Mira pretended not to see. She zipped into her jacket the plastic wallet she had taken from her mother's flat, clipped on her helmet, and adjusted her camera on its branded strap across her chest. The camera didn't work. She'd found it at the tip, still in its carry case, defunct. But she had taken to heart a reminiscence of her father's, who in his youth had hitchhiked all around the country, that no matter how dirty or unshaven he had been, or how far into the wilderness, or how late the hour, whenever he wore his long-lens camera around his neck, he always got a ride. It was an accessory that seemed to put strangers instinctively at ease. Riding into Thorndyke, she met with no traffic at all. Signs along the roadside warned her that the pass ahead was closed until further notice, and advised her to seek an alternative route. It was still before 9, but even in the ordinary quiet of the morning, the town had an eerily abandoned feel. The main street was shuttered. The only sign of life she detected was behind the window of the petrol station, where the teller was counting the day's cash balance into the till. He didn't look up as Mira cycled past, and she continued on up the road without seeing anybody else. Several details in the press coverage of Owen Darvish's impending knighthood had led Mira to believe that he and his wife would not be home when she arrived. It was probably not their only property, first of all. The farm had come to them 5 years ago, and it was clearly surplus to requirements, given that they had planned to subdivide it. The fact that they had taken down the listing following the landslide on the pass proved that they were not in any rush to sell. And Mira saw no reason why a fettered businessman at the high point of his career would spend a winter in deserted Thorndyke if he had the option, and possibly several options, of being somewhere else. Second, she was reasonably certain that it was not a working farm. The realtor's listing had described it as a former sheep station, and as the satellite map had shown, the Darvishes were not in the habit of shutting their gates, which would have been unthinkable if they were keeping livestock. Rural authenticity was no mere detail that a journalist might have overlooked. If, in addition to managing a successful business, Darvish had kept even the smallest flock of sheep or herd of cattle, it would have surely been reported, in the national papers most of all. Last, there was the partnership between Darvish Pest Control and the American tech giant Autonomo, which Darvish had mentioned in every interview that she had read. The project was soon to launch in Northland, the northernmost province of the North Island. And his pride in the project had been so palpable, and his excitement in the new technology so boyish and eager, that Mira felt sure that he would want to manage it firsthand. It was possible, of course, that even in his absence she would find the house tenanted, or the fields leased out to neighbours' flocks as winter feed. But Darvish had made such a point of his Korowai connection in the press that somehow Mira doubted he would dare. She was almost at the barricade when she realized from the incline of the hills around her that she must have passed the Darvish driveway by mistake. She doubled back and soon discovered why she'd missed it. Evidently, in the time since the map on her phone had last updated its street view, the Darvishes had renovated. The main approach to the property was no longer through a standard farm gate over a cattle stop, as she had been expecting, but through a pair of curving wrought iron gates set into a rather ugly semicircular stone wall. The gates were closed and appeared to be motorized, judging by the metal boxes that encased the lowest hinges on either side. Coming closer, she saw a hooded keypad on a metal post, and above the keypad, an intercom that presumably communicated with the house. She could see no camera, and after a moment's hesitation, she wheeled her bike up to the keypad, cocked her foot on the pedal, and firmly pressed the call button. If anybody answered on the other end, she told herself, she would just ride away. The house was far enough back from the road that it would surely take a couple of minutes for Darvish, or his wife, or any one of the friends or family members who might be minding the house in their absence, to appear, by which time she would be well on her way back to town. She waited, but nobody answered, and the iron gate stayed closed. Mira dismounted and took the printed maps out of her mother's plastic wallet and sat down on the driveway to examine them. It was impossible that a farm of this size would have only one point of access from the road, and sure enough, when she pored over the satellite image, she could see a rutted vehicle track running straight across the hillside to the southern fence. The track was so direct in its course and terminated at the fence line so abruptly that it could only indicate an exit, in which case the strip of bare ground beyond the boundary, which she had taken for a firebreak, must be an unsealed service road connecting the highway with the back end of Korowai National Park. She got back on her bike and cycled up the hill again, going further this time than she had before. She had been right about the service road. It was unmarked and so well concealed behind a curve in the highway that even on her bike she might have missed the turning had she not been looking for it. The gravel was too deep and too uneven to allow her to continue on at any speed, so she stashed her bicycle in a patch of scrub and proceeded up the road on foot, carrying one of her panniers as a backpack, and reflecting what a rare pleasure it was to be able to hear only birdsong, her own footfall, and the distant sound of the wind. By the time she reached the second gate, There was a second gate. She'd been right about that as well. She was perspiring. She peeled off her jacket and tied its arms around her waist, welcoming the chill. And as she caught her breath, she shaded her eyes with her hand and looked out over the valley in appreciation of the view. She'd gained enough elevation that the highway had shrunk to a silver band beneath her, and the clustered roofs and wires of Thorndyke now seemed like a set for a model train. The hills on the far side of the lake were bathed in sunlight, their brown and purple slopes transformed to amber, steel, and sage. The sky behind them a perfect watercolor fade from azure down to baby blue. To the north, she could see the rumpled patch of lowland forest where the van was parked, and to the south, the high saddle of the pass, though not, from this angle, the raw channel down the mountainside, nor the colossal mound of rubble or the fractured viaduct that she remembered from the footage on the news. She turned her attention to the gate. It was chained and padlocked, and she could see no obvious tire tracks in the mud that might suggest that anyone had lately driven through. Feeling encouraged, she climbed over it, taking care not to leave any footprints, and set off north across the hill. The track seemed much more overgrown to her eye than it had in the image captured by the satellite. Judging by the height of the grass, the field had not been grazed for at least a season. She looked around for fresh manure, but could see only rabbit droppings. The track proceeded along a shelf of limestone and through a shelter belt of pines, the ground more undulating than Mira's map had made it seem, and the incline of the hill a little steeper. Her view of Thorndyke disappeared, returned, and then disappeared again as she traversed furrow, ridge, and furrow, keeping an eye out for creeks and ponds, but seeing no water at all. There were enough irregular outcroppings of stone around her to suggest caves and fissures in the ground beneath her feet. Little likelihood, then, of a handy water source, at least not this far from the house. She would have to make do with collecting rainwater. Acidic, but the limestone would help to counteract that. And perhaps with filling tanks of water at the lakeside and driving them up the service road at night. She was wondering how often it rained in Thorndyke when she crested yet another ridge and found herself on the edge of a wide, level terrace. An airstrip, she realized, because at the far end, parked with its nose toward her, was an amphibious four-seater plane. The sight of the aircraft was so unexpected that Mira leapt at once for the nearest patch of trees. But after crouching in the bush for several minutes, scanning the hillside furtively, she let herself relax. There was nobody around, and the morning had been so still and quiet that she would certainly have heard the engine noise if the plane had landed any time in the last hour. It must have been parked there for at least a little while, possibly overnight, or even longer. Had Owen Darvish, or his wife, been learning to fly? But again, this seemed like the kind of humanizing detail that would surely have made it to the press. All the more, she thought, shaking her head slightly, because they had given up their house to search and rescue following the landslide on the pass. Mira considered her options. If the plane was in frequent use, then her activities on the farm would need to be invisible from the air, as well as from the house or from the road. Collecting rainwater in tarpaulins would be risky, as would planting or cultivating anywhere without shelter readily to hand. Then again, the farm was large, with a great many possible sites for planting, and the plane was parked near the top of the property, at least a kilometre above the house, which itself was a good few hundred metres above the road. Anybody wishing to take off would either have to enter at the front gates and drive up the main track, or enter by the service road, the way that Mira had come, and cut across the hill. And either way, she would have fair warning and a chance to hide. She decided to make her way down to the house to reassure herself beyond a doubt that nobody was home. Keeping as much as possible to the cover of the trees, she struck out for the more rutted track that led down the hill, scanning the fields around her and listening out for the sound of voices or a four-wheel drive. But there was little need for subterfuge. Descending on the house, she saw that the light in the rear porch was on, and when she tried the tap by the garage, nothing happened. The mains water had been shut off. She cupped her hands around her eyes and peered in the garage window. The interior was too dark to make anything out, so she got out her phone, intending to shine its torch through the glass to get a better look, and discovered to her annoyance that it was dead. Stupidly, she had forgotten to switch it to a power-saving mode. It must have used up its battery searching for a signal. She put it back in her pocket. The house was better lit, and through the kitchen window she could see that the interior was spotless, the fruit bowl empty, all the surfaces bare of clutter, nothing in the sink or on the stove. The place was a classic Kiwi bungalow, white weatherboard with blue-grey trim, maybe 80 or 90 years old. It was in good condition, freshly painted and re-roofed, and when she walked around to the front, Mira saw that the lounge room had been extended, apparently quite recently, to create a double-height picture window with views over the lake. She kept walking, peering in through all the windows in turn. Every room was tidy, and all the beds were neatly made. The only sign of recent occupancy was an off-road vehicle parked askew beside the woodshed, but it was covered with a fine layer of dust, and when she touched the handle of the driver's door, her finger made a clean dark stripe in the grey. Nobody had driven it for at least a few days. Satisfied, she left the house and continued down the hill. The part of the farm the Darvishes had been hoping to subdivide lay below the house, along the highway frontage. And as she neared the bottom of the driveway, she found herself looking down on a vast mound of gravel that had been dumped in the paddock nearest the main gate. This was presumably in preparation for the private road the Darvishes had planned to build, which would give drive-on access to each subdivided plot, terminating, she remembered from Mrs. Crowther's correspondence, in a roundabout landscaped with tussock grass, flax, and local stone. The realtor had supplied Mrs. Crowther with an artist's impression of what the little street might one day become, a fresh and vibrant sketch depicting elegant, sun-drenched homes, shining SUVs at the curbsides, laughing children, and healthy people walking happy dogs. All set against a lush backdrop of mature trees that would have had to have been planted, Mira reckoned as she looked around her, maybe 10 or 15 years ago at the very least. There was nothing in the field except stubby grass and the pile of gravel. No string lines, no mixers or excavators. Not even any tire tracks from the truck that must have brought the gravel there. It would seem the subdivision plans had well and truly stalled. At the northern fence, she met with even more good fortune. The dilapidated shearing shed and livestock pens that on the map she had taken to be part of the neighbouring property were in fact situated on Darvish land, offering ample room for storage, and even a place to hide the van, if she ever figured out how to get around the code on the front gate. The slatted fences of the pens were bleached with age and falling down in places, but they offered some concealment, as well as shelter from the wind. She counted 9 galvanized water troughs, and more than a dozen slimy bales of straw, years old, but perfect for mulching. Surely nobody would miss a bale or two. As she knelt down to feel the texture of the soil, Mira was suffused with a restless, excitable energy, already mapping out in her imagination where every bed and every crop would go. The open fields beside the road were too exposed to be of any interest, and so she headed back up the hill again to take a closer look at the plain. It was now well afternoon. Driving south, she had gained a few degrees of latitude. Sunset would be early, especially in the valley, where the light would fade rapidly once the sun had sunk behind the ranges in the west. After she had explored the upper paddock, she told herself, she would return to the campsite and fill the water tanks at the lake. Then, after nightfall, she would drive the van up the service road and unload the contents over the fence, ready to begin preparing the site in earnest the following day. She was just forming this resolution in her mind when she returned to the airstrip, and a man stepped out from behind the plane. He was in his 40s, lean, smooth-faced, and wearing a navy tracksuit and an unbranded baseball cap. His clothes looked new, and in the split second before either of them spoke, Mira found herself recalling, bizarrely, a comment by her cousin Eve, who was the mother of 2 small children, and who had once remarked despairingly to Mira that when it came to children's clothing, you had to spend a lot of money to look like you were hardly spending anything at all. This man's tracksuit was so ordinary and unassuming, and so simply cut, that Mira felt absolutely certain it was more expensive than any garment she'd ever owned. Her heart was thumping, but she knew that the best strategy, in these moments, was to pretend that she had every right to be exactly where she was. So she smiled and waved as he approached, striding forward confidently to meet him halfway. "Another beautiful day," she said warmly, spreading her arms wide. He didn't return her smile.
"Who are you?"
he said, when he was close enough to speak without raising his voice. He had an American accent.
"Sarah Foster," Mira said, choosing one of her false identities. "With the production. Is that your plane?"
He didn't answer.
You're trespassing, he said.
Well, that's kind of my job, Mira said with a little laugh. I'm a location scout. Any house with a view of a lake is my brief. Been all around the country and haven't found it yet, but that's the nature of the beast. Is that your plane?
What do you think? He said.
I think it's a pretty nice plane, Mira said, laughing again. Must be magic once you're up above it all. It'd make my job a little easier, one of those.
He didn't smile. He was staring at her, unblinking, his expression cold. Then he said very quietly,
Who do you work for?
She frowned, pretending consternation.
My producer was in touch last month, she said. Ben Sharp? He said he cleared it with the farmer. Someone called Darvish, I think it was.
Cleared what? The man said.
Well, we're just taking photos at this stage, Mira said. No promises. But of course, with the landslide on the pass, no traffic, nobody around, what better time to make a movie?
A movie?
He repeated.
That's right, Mira said. I can't tell you what it is, unfortunately. Non-disclosure, all of that. But it's an international production, quite big. And there are a few names attached already. I'm excited. And God knows the economy around here could use the boost. What about you? Are you visiting?
He didn't answer.
I thought I heard an American accent, Mira said.
She was cursing her choice of cover story. Ordinarily, she could trust that the allure of Hollywood would dazzle whomever she was speaking to. But he didn't seem dazzled in the slightest. He didn't even seem curious. She hoped he wasn't from the movie industry himself.
Say your name again, he said.
Sarah, Mira said. Foster, what's yours?
He said nothing. He was studying her face.
Mira was starting to sweat. She kept her voice light. Well, anyway, the house I'm looking for is supposed to be English, she said, turning away from him to gesture out over the hillside. Somewhere in the Lake District, but you know, it's Hollywood, so close enough. We're hoping to start shooting in the summer.
How did you know I was here? He said.
I didn't, Mira said. I have no idea who you are. I mean, no offense, I'm sure you're really important if you've got your own plane.
Again, he said nothing. He raised his eyebrows a little, making it clear he didn't believe her, and waited. She smiled bravely and lifted up her camera.
Only taking photos, she said. I swear.
You've been on this property 4 hours, and you haven't taken out your camera once, he said.
Mira's smile faltered in a way that was partly performed and partly real.
Look, she said. Honestly, my producer cleared this with the farmer weeks ago. Feel free to ring him up if you don't believe me. Owen Darvish is the farmer's name.
You're lying, he said.
Mira tried to laugh.
I don't know what to tell you then.
There is no production, said the man. And your name's not Sarah Foster.
She made a show of patting down her pockets.
I don't think I have a card on me, she said. But like I said, Ben cleared everything with Mr. Darvish, so give me the camera, said the man.
He put his hand out. Mira took another step back.
Hey, she said. I think you've got the wrong idea. I honestly don't know who you are, or what you're doing here, or what's going on.
He took another step forward.
Give it to me, he said.
No, she said.
Mira, he said, I am asking nicely.
It chilled her to hear him use her name. Dumbly, she was starting to tremble, she slipped off the carry case and held it out. He took out the busted camera and turned it over, saw the cracked display screen. Tried the power button, then opened the back and peered into the empty cavity where the battery should be.
How do you know my name? She said.
He ignored the question.
This is broken, he said, holding it up.
I know, Mira said.
What are you doing here? He said. Don't lie.
I'm a gardener, Mira said. I plant things on other people's properties without them knowing, and in public places. And I cultivate the plants and water them and then harvest the produce at the end. And I'm part of a collective. We're like an activist collective. Only I'm here in Thorndyke on my own. It's just me. But a lot of people know I'm here, she added quickly. A lot of people would come looking for me if anything.
She found that she couldn't go on.
He didn't flinch.
Keep talking, he said.
I truly have no idea who you are, Mira said. And I've never met this Darvish guy before in my life either. I just read about him in the news, and I figured that since the pass is closed, and he's just about to become a knight or whatever, there was a good chance he'd be away, and that's why I came here, because the town's cleared out, and it seemed like a good opportunity. And I thought I could maybe get in a growing season before they open up the pass again, and things go back to normal. All the stuff I said about the movie was a total lie. There's no Ben Sharp, he doesn't exist. And my name's not Sarah Foster, it's Mira, like you said. Mira Bunting. And that's the whole story. That's the truth.
He listened to this in perfect stillness, his eyes fixed on hers, hardly even seeming to breathe. He didn't move or speak after she fell silent. They looked at each other for 1 second, 2 seconds, three. And then Mira turned and ran, not looking back, not slowing. Not even when she reached the shelter belt, the gate, the graveled service road, the patch of scrub where she had stashed her bike, which she'd dragged to the highway, bashing her shin on the crossbar in her haste to get astride it, and pedaled furiously down the hill, past the renovated driveway, along the lakeshore, into town, and past the solar-powered signs that warned the pass ahead was closed. By the time she reached the campsite and skidded to a halt beside the van, she was drenched in sweat, her windpipe ragged, her legs trembling so violently that she could hardly stand. Still coursing with adrenaline, she clambered off the bike and let it fall away from her, the front wheels spinning as it struck the ground. She had walked only a few weak steps away from it when her knees gave way beneath her, and she fell forward onto the grass. It was over, she thought. She should leave. There was only one road out of Thorndyke, which meant that he knew the direction she had taken. And even if he hadn't seen her bicycle, he had certainly seen her pannier. He knew her alias, her business, her intentions. And he had known more than what she'd told him. He had known she hadn't taken any pictures with her camera. He had known she'd been on the property 4 hours. And somehow, he had known her name. And what did she know about him? That he was American? That he wore expensive-seeming clothing? That he hadn't answered any of her questions? That he had seen through her and had assumed at once that she had seen through him. That he had menaced her, not physically or violently, but quietly, implicitly, expecting his commands to be obeyed. Nothing else. She didn't know what he was doing on the Darvish farm, or how long he'd been there, or how long he planned to stay. She didn't even know if it was his plane. In other words, Jack, Mira thought, in a spike of furious resentment against herself. She knew jack shit about him, and her cover was well and truly blown. She had begun to shiver. She got up and unlocked the van, stripping off her sweat-drenched shirt and bra, and slipping on a dry merino turtleneck that felt clean and soft against her clammy skin. The touch of the fabric was so restoring that she changed her socks and underwear as well, standing in the cubicle formed by the van's open door. Then she leaned over the passenger seat to plug her phone into the cassette converter and put the key in the ignition to charge it. She suddenly felt ravenous. There was a box of snack bars in the glove box, and by the time the phone's display winked back to life, she'd eaten three and was feeling steady in herself again. She climbed into the driver's seat, typed her PIN into the phone, and waited for any messages or emails to download, but none appeared. Batting away the reflexive despondency that always struck whenever she checked her inbox and found it empty. Ridiculous. She had no correspondence anyway. She opened her browser and typed, Owen Darvish Airstrip, into the search field. It cost a fortune to use the internet on data, but Mira's pride would not allow her to leave Thorndyke without at least a partial understanding of what had happened up at the Darvish farm. In all her years at Burnham Wood, she had never met anybody she had so completely failed to charm. There had to be a reason, and for the sake of the collective, she had to find it out. Everything about the site was perfect, and she hated the thought of letting it go simply on account of a single brief encounter with a stranger, who, for all she knew, might have been trespassing as well. For now that she was alone and the threat had passed, she had begun to feel embarrassed that she had ever felt afraid of him. Her first search revealed nothing of interest, so she tried Owen Darvish Plane, Owen Darvish Pilot, Thorndyke Private Plane, Thorndyke Private Airstrip, all without success.
Owen Darvish, American, resulted in a deluge of news articles about the partnership between Darvish Pest Control and Autonomo, the American company that manufactured drones, and Autonomo New Zealand, Autonomo Thorndike, Autonomo National Park Drones, and Autonomo Korowai, all directed her back to the same dozen articles she'd already read. She switched her search mode to images and typed Autonomo on its own, and found him. Her stomach lurched. The picture was a few years old at least. His face was a little fuller, his hair a little longer, his cheekbones a little less pronounced. But it was unmistakably him. He was pictured sitting on a leather Chesterfield, legs thrust out, ankles crossed, both arms extended casually along the back. Pits to the wind was what Mira's father always said whenever he saw a motorcyclist with ape hanger handlebars. Spread those pheromones. And this was the phrase that now appeared in Mira's mind. His chin was slightly raised, and he was looking into the lens with the same expectant, disbelieving expression that he had worn with her.
Is that it? He seemed to be saying to the camera. Did you really think that I would fall for that?
She clicked on the image and learned that he was one of the co-founders of Autonomo. He had been the CEO of the company in its early years, and now served on its board of directors. He was a serial entrepreneur, a venture capitalist, and apparently a billionaire. His name was Robert Lemoyne. She heard engine noise behind her and glanced at the rearview mirror to see a black SUV turning into the campsite. It had tinted windows and looked new. It looked, in fact, like just the sort of vehicle a serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, former CEO, company director, billionaire would choose to drive. Heart sinking, she willed it to be just a tourist in a flashy rental. But then it pulled up right beside her, and Lemoyne got out. The key was already in the ignition. It would need only another quarter turn to start the engine. Moving discreetly, Mira released the handbrake and placed her feet on the footbrake and the clutch. Her bike was in her blind spot, right behind the van. She would have to run it over if she reversed in a hurry. And the passenger door was still open. Her duffel bag, which was on the passenger seat, would probably tumble out. Even as she was making these calculations, he appeared at the driver's window and held up the broken camera.
Sorry, he said. Here.
She wound down the window and he passed it through to her. She took it with her left hand and held it on her lap, looking at him, waiting for him to speak. Her feet were still on the pedals, and her right hand was inches from the key in the ignition. Her heart was beating fast. After a moment, he said,
I guess we got off on the wrong foot up there.
I guess we did, Mira said.
My name's Robert, he said. I'm sorry to have frightened you. I thought you were someone else.
Someone else named Mira? He smiled. Instead of responding, he took his phone out of his pocket, tapped the screen, then turned it around to show her. Under the list of detectable devices nearby was listed Mira's iPhone.
Next time, try leaving it at home, he said.
Mira was embarrassed that she had been so easily unmasked. She put her left hand on the gear stick, ready to place it in reverse. Robert what? She said to cover her embarrassment. He glanced down at her phone, still plugged into the cassette converter, and balanced on her knee. And for an awful fraction of a second, Mira wondered if her search results were visible. But mercifully, the screen was dark. Heart still pounding, she squared up to him again. Robert what? She repeated. He didn't answer. He was searching her expression, still with the trace of a smile.
You seem like a smart young lady, he said at last. I'm sure you'll figure it out.
He went back to the SUV and opened the driver's door. But before he got in, he paused and looked at her across the bonnet.
See you up there, he said. Just stay away from the airstrip. I can take off all right, but I'm still learning how to land.
He got into the driver's seat and shut the door. Wait, Mira said, but he was already starting the engine and backing the SUV out of the campsite. Wait, she said again and scrambled out of the van. What do you mean? The driver's window lowered silently.
I mean, he said, one hand on the wheel. I'll stay out of your way if you stay out of mine.
She was still confused. Why? He smiled.
Why?
Yeah. Why would you do that?
Because you intrigue me, Mira Bunting. and I want to see your garden grow.
She came closer. What about Darvish?
What about him?
You're not going to tell him?
He was about to reply, and then seemed to change his mind.
No, really, he said after a long pause. Where would the fun be in that?
He went to put the window up. Wait, Mira said again, but she had detained him before she had a question ready. He was looking at her expectantly, and so she said the first thing that came into her head. What's the code for the front gate?
He grinned broadly, showing a perfect set of square white teeth.
6061, he said. It's the house number backwards. Anything else you want to ask?
Yes, Mira said. How do I know you're not setting me up?
You don't, he said.
He put the window up and drove away. About half an hour later, Mira heard the distant buzz of a light aircraft, and she looked up to see his plane climbing up out of the valley, then banking west, over the lake, over the hills, and out of sight.